Good afternoon. I apologize for our tardiness, and I beg your pardon. We've had a minor, modest change of schedule. This is the subcommittee of general government, House Ways and Means, and we would like to go ahead and have the public hearing portion of Senate Bill 5502 relating to bonds with testimony from Chuck Smith and Greg Jeffrey, if you would please, from the Debt Management Division and the Department of Administrative Service. We won't be able to go into work session until we have a portion of this finished up anyway. Would you like to go ahead and start, sir?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chuck Smith, and I'm the Director of Debt Management for the Oregon State Treasury. For over 15 years, the state of Oregon has had a highly centralized and managed debt issuance process. This process has been very successful, as measured by our improved bond ratings and reduced cost of borrowing for state-level programs. The debt issuance process incorporates the executive and legislative branches of state government, as well as the independently elected state treasurer. Essentially, the process works like this. The executive branch includes in the governor's budget biennial recommendations for the maximum amount of state obligations that may be issued for each state program. The legislative branch sets limits on the issuance of all state bonds and other financing obligations on a program-by-program basis. And finally, the state treasurer acts as the coordinator and issuer of all state debt. In recent years, Oregon has experienced significant population increases coupled with rapid growth in a far more diversified economy than that which existed in the early 1980s. State infrastructure systems that have been adequate in the past are under study for review for their adequacy in the future to provide for additional increases in population, competition in an increasingly global economy, and the maintenance of the quality of life. Many proposals made to respond to the changing needs in transportation, housing, education, public safety, and natural resources entail significant state capital investments over lengthy periods of time. To enhance advice given to policymakers respecting state financing capabilities, and to better integrate capital financing needs with available debt capacity, the 1997 Oregon Legislative Assembly created the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission. The commission was given the responsibility of advising state decision makers on policies and actions that enhance and preserve the state's credit rating and maintain the future availability of low-cost capital financing. Additionally, the commission provides a six-year forecast of state debt capacity and compares debt capacity to the six-year capital facilities plan that identifies projects proposed to use financing for their acquisition or construction. The commission has published several reports on bonding and debt capacity issues, most recently in the 1999 legislative update, which was published in January of this year. I think the key is the proposed bonds and other financing obligations as contained in House Bill 5502 are all within the respective target capacity as determined by the Commission. As I noted above, the role of the State Treasurer in the bonding process is to act as the coordinator and issuer of all state debt. In this role, State Treasury personnel work closely with each agency which has received legislative approval for their bonding programs during a particular biennium. The Treasurer, however, exercises independent judgment with regard to the structure, features, and all other financing aspects of each bond sale. The state treasurer is vitally concerned with the financial health of all state bonding programs. Before each bond sale, the agency involved must submit for approval a cash flow projection showing the impact of the bond sale upon their program, as well as the cumulative effect of all previous bond sales. A certificate must also be submitted by the agency's bond advisor, certifying that all appropriate assumptions needed for a complete projection were included and that the assumptions were reasonable. In carrying out his role as bond issuer, the treasurer exercises an independent oversight of all the bonding functions to ensure that it conforms to legislative authorizations governing the bonding process. This coordinated and centralized debt management process has been well received by investors in the state of Oregon obligations as well as the bond rating agencies. House Bill 5502 provides a critical element in carrying out this process in the 1999-2001 biennium. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. I want to express my gratitude to both yourself and Mr. Jeffrey for taking me as a freshman from Eastern Oregon and helping me through some of the issues to understand how it's done in the city. This is certainly a different method. My calculator doesn't even go into the tens of billions, so I brought it all the way over from Ontario for no good reason at all. But I do appreciate your willingness to work with me personally, as I've had questions, and also with Mr. Jeffrey. Are there questions of Mr. Smith at this time?
Mr. Smith recognized. What is the limit to capacity that we're talking about in the U.S. where we would justify this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Netherly, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission divided all the bonds up in the state and other obligations into two basic types. And they proposed a limit with respect to what's called net tax-supported debt. We're well within those limits. The commission determined that the state could issue about $450 million per year of net tax-supported debt. The bonding bill, 5502, calls for an issuance over a two-year period of a little over $500 million. So that's well within the total $900 million capacity that the commission has determined to be available. In addition, the commission set a separate capacity based upon actually a legal limitation for lottery revenue bonds. And that number has recently been revised to about $456 million in additional lottery revenue bond capacity over and above what's already been issued in previous years.
Any further questions? Thank you. Mr. Jeffrey? Oh, I beg your pardon. Senator Troy is recognized.
With regard to the bill, basically, this bill is current at this point in the legislative session, but is there likely at the end of the session to be other things that will need to be included in the bill that we just have to wait for?
Mr. Chair and Senator Troll, I think Greg Jeffrey has some changes to the bill already, so there will be some changing numbers there.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, this is the committee. I've provided you also with a memo that shows some of the changes that we are aware of based on budget changes.
Things will need to be inserted, and we'll have an A in growth, General 5502, number completed with all inserting all the numbers from the very long issues that he has come. There's changes on pages 1, 2, and 3, and we can narrow any
of those. Sure. Question for you. If we somehow or other, as discussion winds down and we don't really make final decisions, we end up going away and coming back again, can we pass such a bill until we really know exactly what we want to have in it?
I think once the budgets are passed, Senator Troll, we'll have a pretty good idea of where we're at with regard to the potential borrowing capacity and borrowing needs. candidate. One thing for them to be passed, another thing for them to be
become law. And so the concern is that they work very closely as we begin the wind down process. I think that each step of the way, the governor's office is involved between the House and Senate.
So we may work this bill, but it may be a work in progress.
It may be a work in progress, and that's why we thought we'd better just go ahead and have a public hearing right now and get these portions of it and any modifications, and then we'll come back to it before it's completed. Thank you.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Greg Jeffrey. My name is Greg Jeffrey. I'm a finance manager with the Department of Administrative Services. I also manage the Certificate of Participation Program for the state, as well as the Lottery Revenue Bond Program. To follow up on Chuck's comments, the dollar amounts in House Bill 5502 are the governor's recommended maximum debt issuance for the 1999-01 biennium. The Oregon statute requires that the governor confer with the state treasurer in arriving at those amounts, which had been done, and the treasurer had concurred with the amounts that were submitted. House Bill 5502 does not authorize expenditures. Instead, what's required is that every agency operating the bond program or involved in bond programs must have the revenue and expenditure authorities necessary approved by the legislature or the emergency board. There's a significant coordination and cooperation amongst the state agencies regarding debt management issues. There's been a bond advisory or state bond committee appointed by the governor that's been operating for the past approximately 7 years that facilitates that coordination and communication between the bond agencies with DAS as well as with the state treasurer's office. House Bill 5502 also allocates Oregon's private activity bond allocation. Private activity bonds are a special class of bonds that are laid out and permitted under the federal tax law. It's not an additional authority. It's an authority within the existing authority that's granted to special state bond programs. The private activity bond cap currently is identified as just over $162 million per year. It's done on the calendar year rather than the state fiscal year. If the private activity bond cap should be increased, and it's really based on state population, there's an authority for the private activity bond committee, to address that additional authority that might be available. The amendments that we wanted to identify to House Bill 5502 amounted to four changes in the amounts. The first was for the Article 11G, General Obligation Bonds for Higher Education. It's on the back page of that information that I distributed to you. It would be the original amount has been revised down to $37.7 million. The Article 11F bonds are also general obligation bonds that are issued by higher education, and that amount's been increased from 147 to 134.2. The transportation revenue bond authorization has been reduced from 285 down to 58.4. And the Certificate of Participation Authority, originally requested at just over $371 million, has been increased to $382 million. In the case of higher education, the adjustments were made to match the changes that were approved as part of this capital construction budget. In addition, the Article 11F authority was increased to handle projects that may surface during the course of the biennium. If, in fact, that happens, they would need to come back to the E-Board to get the authority to act on those projects. The Transportation Authority reduction was based on changes in transportation budget. In the case of the participation, that amount was increased. The cause had been the corrections portion, that had originally been developed had been reduced slightly. The Department of Administrative Services facilities portion was increased to reflect increases in project cost estimates. Those are some of the projects that the committee looked at yesterday in the capital construction bill. The military project that was also requested by LFO to be added to the COP authority is also reflected in that increase. The one other element that at one point would need to be changed is the lottery revenue bond authority, and that change, which I believe the committee was referring to earlier, would be modified based on the budget decisions. And I would close by saying that representatives from the various bond programs, I believe, are here today and would be willing to answer any questions that the committee might have about their requests.
Okay, I think that would be important. How many representatives are there, Mr. Jeffrey, that wish to testify or add testimony to the relative to 5502, Senate Bill 5502?
No. Mr. Chairman, I believe what their expectation is that they would be available to answer any questions that the chair or the commission or committee might have. I think that's what their expectation is.
Are there questions of members of the committee for Mr. Greg Jeffrey? The various types of bonds and borrowing include all the various types of certificates of participation, as well as revenue bonds and special bonds, general obligation bonds. Are there any questions of members of Representative Krupp?
Why do we, being a freshman legislative body here because of term limits and not having the historical perspective, why do we not count certificates of participation as, in a sense, bonded debt of the state? In terms of how we deal with it as a legislative body. Maybe unfair of me to ask that, but I just am not understanding, I guess, why we use certificates of participation, how we call them that, as opposed to bonds. I mean, essentially, don't they fulfill the same purpose?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, actually, in direct response to your question, for accounting purposes, the state does, in fact, and I think in terms of tracking what the outstanding obligations are of the state in interfacing with the rating agencies and other players in the financial markets, they do, track those obligations in the same manner as they do other outstanding bonds. But I think it connects to the nature of what the credit is, when you look at certificates of participation. What they're recognized as is an appropriation credit. And by that, it means that really the legislature is not binding subsequent legislators or legislatures to paying the COP debt service schedule for subsequent biennials. Instead, that's a decision that's left up to subsequent legislators to make.
What I hear you saying is that we're not binding future legislatures to fulfill the debt obligation in the same manner that we are with bonds.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Why then do we, what reasoning would anyone have to essentially lend money based on a certificate of participation if there's no binding authority for the repayment of that debt?
Okay, Representative, that's a very good question. And there are, in fact, that's an area that the financial market, participants are extremely sensitive to. And so what they look to is really the state's policy, with regard to how it utilizes certificates of participation. In the case of Oregon, as with most other uses, first and foremost, they look at what kinds of assets, what kinds of projects, you know, the state is utilizing certificates of participation, you know, to provide the funding for. They're looking for them to be using them to fund essential assets, such as Oregon State Prisons, that are necessary for delivering successfully core state services, you know, such as, you know, public safety, as in the case of prisons. In addition to that, what they generally require is that the asset that's being financed be pledged as collateral, so that in the event that a subsequent legislative assembly makes the determination not to make the scheduled COP payment, then what happens in effect is that the state uses or loses its right to occupy and utilize that facility for the remaining term of the financing. It doesn't lose its ownership. It still remains entitled to the asset.
It seems to lose the right to occupy the space,
right,
essentially.
Okay.
Appreciate that.
Just a question, maybe from a different higher ed can explain it, but why we have revised down the Article 11G bonds from 67 to 37 million. Why that took place?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that amount is consistent, you know, with the specific projects, you know, that had been identified and approved as a part of the higher education capital project bill.
I mean that some projects had been put forward and were computed in the 67 and then were dropped when it got to the 37. Is that what happened?
Chairman, Senator Trowe, that's my understanding, yes.
Relative to the, coming back to the certificate participation, Mr. Jeffries, so that I understand, as you and I were working through a certificate participation the other day, I think the indication was that we do buy an insurance of some kind in order to ensure and increase the level from an A level to a double or a triple A level. So some of those certificate participation, they actually pay a little higher upfront fee in the form of bond issuance costs or debt issuance costs, if you will, and they're actually rated very similar to our state rating with that insurance that we buy for basically assurance of payments that Representative Krupp was referring to. Is that not the case?
Mr. Chair, that is true. All of the COPs that the state has issued have been insured by one of the major bond insurers that operate in the United States. And in fact, the lottery revenue bonds that the state has issued have also been insured. And you're correct that these insurers have a AAA credit rating. And when they have stamped, you know, their insurance on these COPs or bonds, then those bonds are traded, you know, at the insurer credit rating. If they weren't to be insured, they'd be issued, we've requested and obtained underlying ratings, you know, for the program, which had been rated as A+. If the COPs were to be issued as uninsured, you know, they'd be traded at the A+ rating. And we've made the determination that's required, you know, of Treasury and DAS with each issue to get a verification that the insurance premium that we're paying relative to the present values, you know, of the interest savings that we're realizing as a result of a higher credit rating is in the state's favor.
And that insurance premium that we pay as a part of the issuance cost of those certificates of participation for financing agreements basically adds additional comfort, if you will, and
but it adds no further binding responsibility on the state from one biennial to the next.
That's correct.
Okay, Jim. Representative Kraft, did you have another question?
So, what's the real reason we need the bill?
Authority to borrow.
I think the bill serves a couple of different purposes, and Chuck Smith referred to them a little bit earlier. I think what it does is it indicates, it underscores a comprehensive look, that the state takes when it's looking at bond issuance, that it's contemplating issuing in the upcoming biennium. It gives the Legislative Assembly the opportunity to have that same comprehensive look. Very often when you look at and review independent individual budgets, you're not getting them, you're not looking at that, Adam, within the whole picture. So this gives you an opportunity to come back, and to see how it fits. And it also, so I'd say primarily those are probably two of the important reasons behind this bill.
Are we, in this authorization, are we expanding the amount of any type of a debt limit for these types of instruments? Anything beyond what we have currently been utilizing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there each of the general obligation bond authorities in the Constitution has its own debt limit. In those instances, this is what's allowed to be issued during the course of the upcoming biennium, and it's well within that overall cap or limit that's set for the GO bonds. And I think the same is true for a lot of the revenue bond authorities.
You look at the constitutional authority to borrow with these programs, they're just a small fraction of the ability that we have to borrow that we're actually borrowing at. I think that's a greater concern, is something that we've talked about from time to time here on this committee, and that is the issue of having singular, maybe two sources of repayment coming from property tax and income taxes, and that's been a concern in my sector. Why don't we go ahead and ask Dallas Lyons, the legislative official, go ahead and give us a summary from his memorandum and regarding the bond limitation issue on these issues. And then if we feel like there's a need to come back and explore issues relative to the general bonds, general obligations, or the pass through of revenue or security for participation, we could do that at that time. Mr. Lyons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As we discussed, this brings together all the borrowing authority, if you will, for various projects and programs in state government. Those projects and programs are subject to legislative review in the budget process and have been reviewed by the Assembly through the various subcommittees and ways and means for various substantive committees. And this does bring the borrowing limits together. There are some changes that are going to have to be made based on changes to budget. You have in my little the same numbers that Mr. Jeffries has provided in his, which can be looked at as either encouraging that we have the same numbers or that we are scheming to have the same numbers. But we have been working together with the Department of Administrative Services. The bill is not ready yet to go forward, even with these changes. And the changes, again, are the result of the budget process. There's two reasons that there are still a couple of issues open. A certain amount of lottery-backed revenue bond projects have been approved in House Bill 2153 or are in the process of being approved. They've gone through the House and have yet to go through on the Senate side. But in addition to that, there are some K-12 lottery-backed bonds that are still subject to negotiation and an amount yet to be determined in the whole budget process, and that will affect the amount of lottery tax revenue bonds. Again, subject to the limitation that has been, I'm not sure if it's in statute, but certainly the intent is to stay within the limits of the debt policy advisory commission that they've established for water utility funds. The other issue is on certificates of participation. In the revised amount, the $382,265,000, that includes funding for Type 1 for the Women's Prison and Intake Center. Should that budget change in the negotiations, then this amount may have to change also. This has been reviewed not only by myself in our office, but our various staff in our office who have worked the various budgets and they concur with these amounts and have provided these numbers that are the changes that we would recommend when we go to work session. Tentatively we are scheduled to review this bill again on Saturday. This Saturday. That's the tentative schedule. We've got a schedule that's been for the subcommittees will be working on Saturday and the full committee Sunday afternoon.
Sunday at 4.
And then we get on Monday, I believe.
Saturday, we're scheduled
all day, I believe.
Yes, there'll be morning session and afternoon session in the committee. Saturday, committee day, though, is in session day. I can't say as the session, Senator, it depends on each body at that point.
Are we talking about the House or the Senate, too?
The joint committees on raising meetings.
Okay.
We're talking about the committees are meeting on Saturday, both morning and afternoon.
Yes, sir.
And if we have a session, we're just excused, is that right?
On Saturday?
Yeah.
Yes, it's my understanding that we would have to ask for excuse in order to work our subcommittees during the day on Saturday, and we tentatively scheduled 2:30 on Sunday to wrap up this bond issue in order to get it on to Monday at 4:00 on the full, and that would be probably under the House or Senate rules with the 1 hour notification. Probably we'll go sign it by
imminent.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the
ace makes a race.
If you're intending to follow the schedule we've been following in the morning, the Transportation Economic Development Committee and the afternoon general government,
but pending outstanding issues would still be Lottery-backed bonds for K-12, and then, of course, the prison side of the issues, the additional finance that may be required for the administrative services. Are there any other questions, or does anyone feel that they need to ask?
Senator Lim? Yes, this is a state debt, the policy or the advisory commission. I understand it's 5 members, and you know why we have a 3 members from the treasurer. And one member DAS and one member public seems to me treasure about everything they can do there if they want to buy the three members. Maybe I have another
head. Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, there's one member from the treasurer. The chair is the state treasurer. It's a 5-member committee. There's one member from the Senate. There's one member from the House. There's the director of the Department of Administrative Services. There's a citizen appointed by the governor, and the chair is the treasurer. So there's only one state treasurer.
Okay. I read it here. The committee consists of 3 members representing treasurer. That's why I thought it was 3 members from treasurer, from this statement here. Thank you.
And they're on a pretty tight ship, Senator.
I guess so.
Other questions or comments? Thank you very kindly. We appreciate you both.
Thank you.
I have a question about the transportation. The deleting of the $285 million and the inserting of the $58,400,000. What does that represent? What's happening?
I have a member from transportation here. I'm a staff for transportation.
Sure.
shareholder, Senator Tro, for the record. My name is John Fink, and I'm the State Infrastructure Bank Manager for the Department of Transportation.
Mm-hmm.
When we developed our budget, we were looking at a significant bonding program to do a large preservation program in the state, and that was actually going to be about $230 million. Subsequent to the development of the budget, we realized that program really wasn't going to pay for itself. So we deleted it from the budget, and that's why this change is necessary. Excuse me.
How did you think it would pay for itself before you decided it would be?
When we were looking at the program, we were looking at doing a preservation program that would basically allow us to save money in the future based on advancing a lot of preservation work. It took a lot of effort to look at the numbers and look at exactly how much we thought we would save by advancing those projects. And in the final analysis, we really didn't save enough to pay for the debt service and to pay for the rest of the program.
My understanding that you're considering in the Senate the possibility of at least as part of the package that passed out of the House, a 2 cent major, I think $725 million package, which may or may not, depending upon what the status is currently, take part of the place of that. Would that be correct, Mr. Chair?
Chair Butler, House Bill 2082, at least the Bean Growth version of House Bill 2082, actually sets a separate $600 million revenue bond limit that is apart from the limit that's in Senate Bill 5502.
So that could happen, but this is not going to happen.
Chair Butler, Senator Tro, that's correct.
But then if 2082 were to pass and we were to go on to a large-scale preservation program, that $600 million would then be added to the overall transportation debt at that point. Is that your understanding?
Well, Chair Butler, the $600 million is actually a modernization program, not a preservation program. But this, that 2082 would not change the limits in Senate Bill 5502. It basically says that $600 million is basically exempt from the statutory requirements that require the Senate Bill 5502.
So 5502, notwithstanding, the $600 million would just be authorized. And
it would buy something different than this was going to buy.
Chair Butler, Senator Tro, that's correct.
That's my understanding. That would be the SCIP, those SCIP programs, as opposed to the preservation.
Chair Butler, yes. Director Cronican did provide the House Transportation with a list of $725 million for the project.
And the other $125 million on top of the $600 million that House Bill 2082 provides for.
Chair Butler, in the $725 million list, that was a list of potential projects that would be funded with the with the program. We still have to do public involvement and go through some other processes before we arrive at a final list.
Other questions? Senator Cole? Okay. Thank you, Senator. So that I understand that Mr. Lyon, the total of the when the total is arrived at after we finish up with K-12 and the prison system, the $600 million would not show up in the total.
The total limits would change as we make changes.
Okay,
we could do that through the year.
But the $600 million would show up because it's part of the authorized debt of the state, isn't it?
If my understanding of that bill is correct, it would not be included with this bill. The $600 million.
Okay.
And it would be some bill would add it to the
statute. Again, if it's passed in the law, that it would give the borrower the authorization, but not expenditure limitation.
Okay.
This is only this borrowing authorization. This does not provide expenditure limitation. And for everything in here, the limitation, or in the case of non-limited, has been reviewed in other budgets.
And Lindy, I think Mr. Jeffrey pointed out one of the certificates of participation was brought forward yesterday to this committee. And I believe that the amendments to the bill would provide a dollar placeholder finishing limitation, and when the plans are developing, cost it out to come forward with that limitation. But it needs to be providing, if I can hear, $465,000 to that Nathan Armory.
Are there any further questions relative to the public hearing process on House Bill 5502? We can't make a decision on 5502. This was the course of the public hearing. We would like to carry over 5502 so that it could be discussed further in public hearing and potential work session, both for, we're under the 1 hour rule for this, for work session, which is what I'll say is 24 hours. Okay, we could get to, but this is what this actually can work on Saturday. Is when this is scheduled to wrap, so we can post on Friday for work session and any further public testimony. So if that's satisfactory, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing portion of this at this time, and then we'll reschedule this for on Friday for a Saturday final public hearing and possible work session. Any objections ordered? We'll now reopen Senate Bill 527, Capital Construction. My understanding that Capital Construction was posted for possible work session only. Is that correct? We can have testimony invited for this day. Let me just quickly run down for the members of the committee what I know about our current work schedule. It's my understanding that we'll officially work and wrap up the Department of Administrative Services tomorrow, Thursday. That we will get into the legislative budget on Friday, and then Saturday we will finish up the bonds that we have just looked at on the 5502, the bonding capacity, and I think that with this capital construction also will be finished up on Saturday as well as we wrap up, and then as necessary we'll carry over to 2:30 on Sunday before the full Ways and Means at 4:00, and we would handle the emergency fund on Saturday, on Saturday afternoon or on Monday afternoon, or on Sunday afternoon. Saturday afternoon, 3:00. That's your straight away. You could certainly go to 1:00.
I haven't been told officially, but I think it's probably 1:00.
1:00.
Okay.
Okay. So we would do this at 1:00 on Saturday. That would be the scheduled time that there is. There's the wrap up of Senate Bill 5502, as well as the wrap up then of the Senate Bill 5527 for the capital construction, and then the emergency fund. Which would be the remaining resources that would be set aside. Okay. Yesterday we had some input, and I've had a brief opportunity to visit briefly with Dave Smith, and I beg your pardon, Dave White, as I We had some folks here yesterday, and we heard from the military, and we did not hear from the Department of Corrections. And I noticed that Sue Acuff was here from the Department of Corrections. I think it's probably appropriate to Sue. Would you like to come forward and invite testimony from the Department of Corrections?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I am from the Department of Corrections. I don't know what kind of public testimony is like. I'm certainly very open to some questions. If there's one clarification I would like to make, if I might, would be the question that came up on the business between the 151 million and where we stand now. If you will, the 151 million was done, you said, in January.
Sue, do you want to pull that a little closer to you so that we can get that on the record?
January of 1998, and that was specific to the damaged site. Okay. At that point, we were looking to build 1,112 beds. Forecasts since that time have indicated a need for greater numbers. So our initial build now is 1,252. And in addition to that, we do have some inflation costs, demobilization costs, those kinds of things, which do come into play. We did an estimate in the fall of 98 to take a look at both what it would take to build at the damaged site as well as Bay Road. The Bay Road at that point was $181 million, roughly, and damage was $177.8 million. What happened since then, we've learned some things for our capital construction projects, both for Snake River as well as Two Rivers. Did a conference there, included architects, engineers, all our contractors, and have come up with ways for cost efficiency, if you will. Have changed the plan a little bit. Examples would be one dorm in the medium complex now, rather than all cells, differences in corridor size, difference in using a metal building for industry space rather than block construction. So some of those kind of things did allow us to reduce down to 171.7, which is what's recommended by the public safety staff. In addition to that, while I'm here, if you will, Senate Bill 6, which was passed in the last session, did actually require that we do a study and take a look at out-of-state beds to see whether or not the construction within state is effective or whether it is not. We have done those reports. Your staff has them in hand right now for both the change in the women's institution as well as our expansion projects, both of which show that it is more cost effective to do it in-state. For the women's institution, by roughly $4.67 per day, and for the combined expansions, it is $6.70 to the good by doing it in Oregon. There's also one more thing which I think the staff will bring up a little bit later, will be an amendment to the bill. When the Department of Corrections was essentially removed from under the umbrella authority of Department of Human Resources, there was an other funds receiving account which was not established for corrections specifically. We are asking that that be established. It's a generic account. It's just a receiving account. And we're missing it, so we're asking that be included in this bill.
What would the purpose of that be?
It's just a receiving account for any revenues that come in as, quote, an other funds revenue. Could include certificates of participation, could include inmate welfare funds, any of those generic type sources.
So we need a budget line item for the hold open and a miscellaneous revenues item.
There is actually, Mr. Chair, there's actually language which comes in. It's generic for all agencies who have any other kind of other funds revenue.
Okay.
Very same language.
Senator Farrell is recognized.
Chairman, on the cost comparison between Day Island Road and Damage, were there any other cost comparisons made? Or any other sites?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we've done several different costing for different sites. What you have here is specific to the Wolfville bill.
Still curious to have a cost comparison between the Hermiston site and the Wolfenville site.
Mr. Chair, if I might clarify, between the Two Rivers site at Unitilla?
Unitilla.
Okay. We do have those, and I can certainly make them available to you.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
You'd make
that
available
to
the member of the committee?
Sure.
On that note, I could just from memory, I recall that the cost of Unitilla cost for building that the prison was approximately $45 million. So it was significantly less. Primary cost differences are due to the significant on-site and off-site infrastructure costs that are reduced there because they already exist for the prison being currently constructed.
Okay.
So the difference is between the Day Road. Day Road was 177.8. Was that correct?
Mr. Chair, that was the estimate that was done in the fall. We are now at 171.7, just because of the lessons learned and the change in the manner in which we'll do the construction.
It's actually gone down.
It has, sir.
And the cost of, or the increase in beds, it looks like there's 140 beds added. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Those are the cheapest 140 beds we've ever added. and the damage side in the meantime?
We did not do any additional estimates on the damage side. But I can inform the committee, we have made a guarantee that we will build it for 171.7, whether it be at the damage site or whether it be at the Day Road site.
Okay. So we build it for nearly $30 million less than that if you're going to kill on that. No problem.
It's not a good location.
Fellows, can you tell there? Got a prison after another.
Okay, let's stick with our crystal here, and we'll continue on. Thank you very much. Are there questions of Ms. Acuff while she's here? Thank you very much. Just wanted to make sure that everything was online for this, as we approve the capital construction for the governor's recommended $22,076,097 for the projects which have been delineated there. Mr.
Chair Butler, committee members, the only adjustment that the subcommittee would recommend for that $22 million supplemental is that it could be reduced by $5.3 million to $16,772,297. That by adding that supplemental amount, we are able to provide the department with the $171.7 million that they need to construct that facility.
So there's some other money already in the cut.
Chair Butler and Senator Schill, yes. The department has appeared before the emergency board and initially got authority to do siting evaluation and also initial construction authority at the damage site, which was approximately $151 million. So we're supplementing those amounts to get to the $171.7. When the capital construction expenditure authority was provided initially, it was provided for Wilsonville or the Wilsonville Urban Reserve, so it covers both sites.
Do you know the nature of the $5.3 million savings? Do you have a delineation of how we're able to add 140 beds and make that additional savings?
It's a combination of our factors. As Sue mentioned, that there were significant lessons learned. They have reduced the square footage of corridors and the number of corridors. They have, in adding those 140 beds, instead of adding beds that were shelled in, they're dormitory style beds. They're working with Building Codes Division on adoption of emergency rules that would ultimately become permanent that allow them to modify code requirements to, in fact, allow them to reduce the cost of an industry building substantially. So it's a combination of things. Those are the big items.
Great. Thank you very much. Any further questions relative to the corrections portion? State Forestry, now Again, these have been heard in the various subcommittees, but so as to accommodate the members of the committee, and I think probably Representative Messerly has participated. Are there any questions that could bring State Forestry forward, State Forestry Department? Total of $12.303 million. Do we know of any modifications or changes to that request?
Sure, well, we'll just hear basically what the projects are.
You bet. Let's ask Representative from State Forestry to come forward. And
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I'm Clark Seeley. I'm the Assistant State Forester for Administrative Services with the Department of Forestry. Our portion of the bill basically includes four projects. The major project is the second phase and the completion phase of the construction effort for our headquarters here in Salem. That project initially had its beginnings in the 1993 session with the beginning of a site feasibility study, and the major construction effort in phase one was approved by the 1997 Legislative Assembly, and that work is currently underway. As you see on your summary, approximately $11.7 million of our request for this session is a part of that Salem compound construction work.
Steve, how much was phase one?
The initial phase one was approximately $6.7 million, Mr. Chair. The other three projects included in our request for this session fundamentally relate to the coming online, if you will, of the Tillamook State Forest. The Tillamook State Forest, a little over 300,000 acres of state forest land, is managed by both our Forest Grove District on the east side and our Tillamook District on the west side. Our site planning effort, master planning effort for both of those district offices that we completed several years ago indicate a need to expand the facilities at both the Forest Grove and the Tillamook district locations to address the future needs of management of that state forest, part of which relates to the actual on-the-ground need for management as well as the increase in current and expected recreational use of the state forest in the coming decades. So two of the projects relate to the expansion and addition of facilities at those two locations. In the case of the Tillamook office, we've done the site plan work there, and now we're ready to move to the design phase for the expansion. And so the $300,000 identified in the case of the Tillamook office is for that design phase step. In the case of the Forest Grove District Headquarters, we're back one notch and looking at doing the site master plan for Forest Grove District for $50,000.
Can you help me, please, Mr. Steele, relative to the Tillamook State Forest? Why do we need an interpretive center?
Mr. Chair, the interpretive center has its roots and foundation actually in legislation that was passed in the 1991 session with the creation of the concept of a interpretive center to tell the story of the Tillamook Forest from prehistoric origins as well as the more historic origins of the Tillamook burn and fires of the middle part of the century, and then the management of the forest and the reconstruction of the forest, so to speak, since those years. The notion of the interpretive center is to place within the forest itself on the Wilson River Highway between Forest Grove and Tillamook a center where that story can be told. Again, through the process of site master planning and conceptual design in 1995 and 1997, the center now is ready to move forward for design capability during this coming biennium, and the $250,000 supports the actual design of the center itself. I might just, as a parenthetical, indicate that the the overall construction of the interpretive center is expected to take over the next six years, and the revenues for the interpretive center will all come from donations.
I see. So it'll be called the Nancy Ross.
Chair Butler, Senator Crow, there have been several discussions about official names of the center. To my knowledge, nothing has been finalized at this point, but yes, that has been a consideration for her part in the early stages in 1991. Yes.
I thought we'd passed something to do that. I guess not.
Don't recall formal at this point.
Just looking at the design portion of the administrative building and the interpretive center for that facility at $550,000, if that represented 10% of what's going to happen, you'd get a fairly ambitious schedule to collect $5 million approximately of outside money. Is that what we're talking about in donations?
Chair Butler, I believe the estimate for the Interpretive Center is approximately $13 million for the entire package, which includes site acquisition, design, construction, and then at least the first 2 years of operation of the center. And again, would be spread over the next 6 years in terms of collection of donations and so forth. But yes, it is sizable.
Site acquisition is in the forest itself, or is it outside the forest? Or?
Mr. Chair, it is in the forest itself. The location is right adjacent to the Wilson River, and the access being right off the Wilson River Highway. Can't give you the milepost off the top of my head, but it's fairly close to halfway, geographically halfway between Forest Grove and Tillamook.
That's presently privately owned?
It has been a combination of both state and private ownership in that parcel that is under consideration. Part of the attractiveness of the parcel is that it is close to the highway itself, so the access is good. The other attractive part of this particular parcel is that it's well above the Wilson River floodplain, at least as it was measured in 1996, which is as high as the water's been in recorded time. So we see it as a good spot for that purpose.
Okay. Any other questions relative to the $12.3 million for State Forest Department? Thank you very much, Mr. Lee. And then the Department of Transportation. We have representatives from transportation here.
For the record, Representative Butler, member of the committee, my name is Tom Luther, the Department of Transportation. With me today is Ann Crook. Ann is with the current manager of the Aeronautics Division. We'll talk to you a little bit about the projects. Hopefully you've got some questions that are going to fire back at us. There's several kinds of projects that we're going to talk about, the first being those that are associated with our highway program. We've got one project that's scheduled in government camp that's for $1 million, and then there are seven other $1 placeholder projects. I'll go into the government camp one briefly and briefly talk about the $1 placeholder projects on each of the others. And following that, Ann can talk a little bit about the aeronautics projects. Briefly, the government camp project is a project that would deal with replacement of a maintenance station that was built in 1950s. It's a key part of our business of keeping that piece of highway open during the winter months. The building is in very poor condition. Electrical service is at maximum or overflow condition. There is no emergency power supply at the site. The walls are non-reinforced, fracturing and failing. There's no fire alarm systems, those kinds of things. So that's our number one project we've identified. The other project associated with replacement of the site for the Hermiston project manager, the same kind of situation. It's in a long-term lease space. The building is at capacity. It's a very old building. It will not accommodate the needs that we have for our people. Lighting is inadequate. Restrooms are undersized. Just absolutely not able to accommodate the needs that we do have. So that project carries a $1 placeholder. The other project, the Kilburn Maintenance Station, that project was built, the maintenance station was built in 1952, and there's a project that's going to need to be on the drawing board in the near future because it is a project that's going to be happening because of the new Sylvan maintenance, the new Sylvan Highway Interchange project. We'll go through a portion of that facility. Lake of the Woods Maintenance Station also is a $1 placeholder, built in 1966, poor condition, non-ADA compliant, electrical service is a problem, access and so on also are problems. Baker City is just a repeat of the other maintenance stations. Sandingham Rest Area is a project that's going to need to be on the drawing board in the future. It's a project that will add additional lighting, restroom facilities, and parking both in the north and southbound lanes. And then the final two projects, East Portland Maintenance Station is to replace the facility built in 1940. And again, it's too small to accommodate our needs. The equipment and storage, we were unable to get our larger snow removal equipment in out of the weather. The door openings are much too small to get the equipment in to work on or to change the plow blades out, so it needs to be done outside. And then the final project we've got deals with doing the design work of all the above projects. In a nutshell, that's briefly the highway projects. If there are questions, I'd answer those. Otherwise, I'd turn it over to Ann to deal with aeronautics.
Let me just ask one question, if I may. The Hermiston project is for an existing office building. Have you made any studies within the department relative to leasing office space versus outright purchase of facilities?
We've done analysis, Representative Butler. We've done analysis to take a look at replacing the building with new. We've done analysis that looks at a lease option and also options to take a look at moving staff and consolidating them in other locations. And as of now, we feel that the construction away from where it is right now on another piece of ODOT ownership is probably the best way to go.
On existing property that's already owned within the Department of Transportation.
Representative Butler, that's correct.
Any further questions, Mr. Luther, members of the committee? Ann?
Thank you. Again, I'm Ann Frickin, I'm manager of the Aeronautics Division. We've got three projects on state-owned airports that we're planning for. All of these will be funded through the Federal Aviation Administration's Airport Improvement Program. We would apply for a 90% grant, and so these the budgets that you see on here would be 90% funded by the federal government and 10% by state aeronautics funds. Two projects at the Aurora State Airport, which is just north of us on I-5, that's the busiest airport that in the state-owned system. It's very congested, so the projects there are aimed at relieving that congestion. First of all, expanding the ramp, which is the parking area for airplanes, and then building a new taxiway from that expanded ramp to where the hangars are. The rest of the parts listed in there, revising the airport layout plan, is showing that. The other big piece listed in that is relocating the parallel taxiway. The Federal Aviation Administration has asked us to look at that as a way to provide for a greater level of safety at the airport in the future when we could get a more advanced instrument approach at the airport. Under current conditions with the taxiway where it is, we don't meet the standards for the upgraded instrument approach. But that's something we're looking at. The next project listed...
And we have the length at the Aurora Airport to accommodate overflow into the next entry. What's the status that in that regard as to the overall length of that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the runway length right now is 5,000 feet, and that is much more than adequate. We've just done a round of forecasts and into the next 20 years. We won't need the length in the runway at all.
But if in the next 20 to 25 years we get the additional growth at the Portland International so far as cargo and those kinds of things, is there a nominated airport in the area that is to take cargo and those kinds of things as passenger load continues to fill up Portland?
Yeah, Chair Butler, the three general aviation airports that are part of the Port of Portland ownership are designated relievers for Portland International. So those are the designated ones at this point.
Those are all in Portland?
That's correct. Troutdale, Hillsborough, and Molino.
Okay. Thank you.
On the first project that I just talked about, I talked about relocating the parallel taxiway. The second project is purchasing the land to do that. this is all airport property. Again, in our forecast, we show that there is more than ample property zoned airport use to meet the needs for 20 years and beyond. However, most of that at this airport, which is an unusual circumstance, isn't owned by the state, the airport owner. Most of it is under private ownership, though it's already dedicated to airport land. So to move that taxiway, we would need to purchase that from basically private landowners who have hangars on those pieces of property right now. So that's what that project's all about.
That's it. So that's today?
No, that's also at Aurora.
At Aurora. And the 5% local match? What does that mean?
It's a 10% local match.
And so 5% state and 5% local?
On state-owned airports, we normally ask the local community to come up with a 5% match. However, on state-owned airports, that isn't always feasible. And so we will look to the community of airport users in that area to raise those funds.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Shall I go on to Select Space?
Yes, if you would. I beg your pardon.
That's fine. Select Space State Airport is in Glen Eden Beach, just south of Lincoln City. This request is to increase the safety of that airport. The runway length is adequate, but we don't have the area off both of the ends of the runway that's required by an FAA standard as an overrun. There's a ditch at one end of the runway, so the major construction here is to shift the runway, which is in essence extending it on one end and then cutting it shorter on the other end to provide us the ample overrun distance on either side. So the bulk of this project is to do that and then to begin constructing a parallel taxiway. At this point, that runway, that airport is only a runway and no taxiway. And that also creates a safety hazard. If someone lands, they then have to taxi on the runway to get to their hangar, and anybody else waiting to land will have to wait. So, again, that's a congestion and capacity expansion.
That's a parallel runway then?
Parallel taxiway.
Taxiway.
Correct.
Further questions? It's just you and I, very naturally.
Yeah, last of them.
Yeah.
I think there
might
be a technical correction
to make in the Okay. Mr. McGee, you have an issue there that you'd like to present to us?
Very quickly, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill McGee, the Department of Administrative Services. I need to correct my presentation yesterday on the three airport projects. I had indicated those are federal funds. Those are, in fact, extended with other funds. So in the bill, we'd be asking you to approve those with other funds projects.
Those are other funds, the 90%?
The entire project would be extended as other funds. So all three of those should be show entirely as other.
Okay. And as to the state's share, that's going to be the 10%, is that correct?
I believe that the testimony was that they would be looking at local.
There will be some local of 5 and 5.
Yeah.
Okay.
The entire amount there would be other funds.
The previous other funds.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. and State Fair. This is Mr. Brennan was here yesterday. There he is. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Rusty Vernon, Director of Oregon State Fair. Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. State Fair projects are basically to get the buildings back up to a maintainable condition. As you know, we've had several conversations about this, but there have been several of our facilities have been declared unsafe for occupancy and need to be repaired or replaced. The biggest single project that we have is going to be involved with the Horse Stadium, which has substantial issues with the brick walls and some condemned stall structures on the side of that. In addition to that, the 4-H FFA barn, which has been ruled unsafe for occupancy, and the poultry building unsafe for occupancy, and the floral building, which is unsafe for occupancy. All of those facilities obviously are core program issues for us and need to be replaced. Are repaired, and these are critical to the survival of the State Fair.
Questions, and recognize that we have heard the State Fair and another subcommittee, but please proceed, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, when you said the 4-H large capital building, you're talking about the chief, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's the major program building for the livestock operations for the 4-H and FFA portion of the State Fair.
Thank you very much. If there's no further questions, we appreciate it. Thank you for your patience. Oregon Youth Authority, I do not believe that we've had an opportunity as Mr. Dick Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Mr. Johnson is going to be talking about the Whitaker Hall, and he's providing me some photographs he asked me to pass along for you to view.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Dick Johnson. I'm Assistant Director for Business Services for the Oregon Youth Authority. To my left is Gary Lawhead, Superintendent of McLaren School, McLaren Youth Corrections Facility. Just by way of a very brief overview, the Oregon Youth Authority owns and operates 60 buildings at 11 different locations around the state. We have a replacement value of those structures of $106 million. During the last biennium, we completed construction of 6 new facilities, and those are all in excellent condition. We do have older facilities at Hillcrest here in Salem, McLaren in Woodburn, and 4 work-study camps around the state, one in Corvallis, one in Tillamook, one in Florence, and one in LeGrand. These older institutions were constructed between 1923 and 1979 and are in very marginal condition, varied condition. In 1998, we contracted with an engineering and architectural firm to review all of those older structures and give us an assessment of their condition and a listing of the essential repairs for the next 6 years. In their 3-volume report, they produced a list that totals a little over $7 million in needed repairs. We're here today seeking legislative approval of 3 relatively small items to get us started on that path. First, we're requesting a capital construction other funds appropriation in the amount of $134,700 to begin the planning for the replacement of Whitaker Hall at McLaren. Whitaker was built in 1925. It is a 3-story building in very poor condition. The third floor is unsafe and has been abandoned for decades. This spring, during routine repairs, we discovered serious structural dry rot, and you can tell in the photos, it kind of looks like they were on fire, but in fact, that is moisture damage to the interior framing of that building. The consultant's report estimates the cost of repair at over $1.1 million for that structure. That's right about half of its replacement cost. We are now estimating that approximately $2 million in construction might be needed. We're requesting 7% of that amount for the planning and preparation of bid documents so that we can come back to the next session of the legislature for funds to replace Whitaker Hall. The $134,000, the source of that is other funds that we expect or would hope to secure through the sale of some property at McLaren that is now deemed to be surplus. There is approximately a 10-acre parcel of land that is outside our new security fence and is no longer available for the program use that it has served in the recent past. Should we be successful at selling that, we would like to invest those funds in support of this planning effort. The Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety has reviewed this issue and has recommended approval of this request.
Okay. Let me just ask a technical question. Relative to excess properties, doesn't the state have a policy with regard to excess properties that the funds are back into to the Department of Administrative Services? Is there a general fund of excess properties when they're sold?
Mr. Chairman, there is a fund, and the agency is able to petition the Department of Administrative Services for the reuse and rededication of those funds on similar capital investments. This past biennium, we did sell acreage at McLaren to the city of Woodburn, and the proceeds have been deposited in this account at DAS and are being used by McLaren for various capital projects on the campus. This would be treated in kind in the same fashion.
And that's, does that require any oversight other than just the Department of Administrative Services, legislative fiscal, or the legislature be involved in that?
I'm not aware that it does. I can check and make sure. And Mr.
Chairman,
for the record, Joe McGee, yeah. The sale of property, the actual sale would not require legislative approval. The use of the revenues from there, of course, would. And that's why we're asking you for this limitation today.
Okay, so the $134,700, which is the portion that's being requested here, is a portion of the funds which came out of the sale to the city of Woodburn. Is that correct?
Well, we would expect to recover those from the proposed sale of the property in Woodburn.
I see. And the remaining portion from the other acreage that was sold is still vested with the Department of Administrative Services?
Chair, there is a capital improvement issue as well that's in the operating budget that you won't see, but the expected expected remainder of those revenues would go to the capital improvement items.
Those were approved in the public safety.
That would be correct.
Okay. Thank you very much.
One final amendment to that, Mr. Chair, and that is that as it is in Marion County, these projects are reviewed by the Capital Planning Commission. Our second project, we are requesting the transfer of $100,000 in other funds, COP. These are from past sales. We have had two projects approved by the 97 legislature. We overestimated the expenses in one and we underestimated in another, and we're asking for the committee's approval to make the necessary changes between those two projects. This is normally something an emergency board would likely be asked to do, but in this instance we are at a stage in our contracting to require a legislative action as quickly as possible, and we are making that request here today.
That would be a transfer of $100,000 within the capital construction from for McLaren and Hillcrest. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, it is. The funds were originally approved for providing furnishings to our regional facilities. We would propose to use the funds in an effort to enclose several vocational buildings at McLaren within the new security fence. So we would be adding $100,000 to the line for fencing at Hillcrest and McLaren and subtracting the funds from furnishings at the regional facilities.
Okay.
Our third request is an increase in expenditure limitation of $300,000 in other funds that are received from the Federal Violent Offender Incarceration Truth and Sentencing Incentive Grant. These are grant funds from the federal government, and they would augment an appropriate or a limitation established in the January 98 Emergency Board of $3.4 million intended for the construction of a youth accountability camp in Eastern Oregon. The additional funds are needed to meet state standards for wastewater treatment and disposal, increased fire suppression, and other site preparation costs that we're incurring in this project. For the record, we have cited this without superciding authority, and we are proceeding to follow all local, state, and federal requirements, some of which have increased the original cost of this project. When we first received Emergency Board approval for it, we were considering sites that were served by existing public utilities. For one reason or another, those sites were ruled out, and we are now in a state park near La Grande, Oregon, and the cost of developing that site is a little more expensive than we originally estimated. So this funding is available. The federal government has made a commitment, and we're seeking the limitation increase.
$300,000.
Yes, sir.
Questions relative to the Water Use Authority? All this time, Mr. Lawhead's been looking at me like he tries to remember my picture. He's seen it on a post office wall somewhere. He surely recognizes me from my youth, which was just a few years ago. Do you have any comments, Mr. Lawhead?
Oh, here to answer your questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. The only concern I've got is this drive route really does look like you had a fire. You sure you didn't have a fire and didn't know about it?
Mr. Chair, no, I'm pretty sure it wasn't a fire. It's in there every day for a while.
Okay. Pretty extensive. And the third floor of that Whitaker Hall is vacant at this particular point.
Chair, it's been damaged and vacant for several years.
And the replacement is there's. What you're actually considering doing is replacing the facility entirely at this point, or are you just going to continue to use the two lower floors? Is that the proposed? What's the long-term projection of Whitaker Hall?
Mr. Chair, I think the short-term plan would be to continue to operate out of the lower two floors while we, if granted, do the assessment of a more long-term plan. If the new facility would be what comes out of this study. I want to add also that more than just administrations in the building, there's treatment programs and groups that go on in there. Our central control is currently located there with key control and so on, and then also a vocational program with food service, all located in that building.
It meets all the ADA requirements at this point?
For the bottom floor, yes.
But for second and third, it does not?
No, it is not. There's stairways and no elevator.
But the anticipated completion would make it ADA accessible.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Sure. That's in National Record.
Could you give an indication of the life of that building?
The assessment will certainly help us with that, Mr. Chair. It was initially, it's
in constant repair. There's a maintenance staff working on it today as we speak. Our initial assessment is that the building is actually sinking slowly over time. So it is a matter of time when replacement will have to be done.
And years more life, or 5 or 30 or what?
Chair, eventually, I think the indication will be with the study how much immediate repair will have to be done with the estimated $1.2 million already that is estimated to bring it into life, even with the estimated.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mr. Lee, the book that we have at your table contains the latter pages after the pictures is the structural engineer's assessment of the building, and in many cases it cites serious structural deterioration as well as some major systems problems. I mean, part of the cost of that $1.1 million is, in fact, making it compliant with ADA and others. But if you even exclude those, there are some others that they claim are quite urgent in the sense that public health and safety is at some level of risk. We would hope to be able to replace it within 3 to 5 years.
Please. How long have you been aware of the condition of this building?
I think this building has been in deteriorating condition for several years. I think it was only when we had the engineers go in and actually look and probe and poke and get under there that we were aware of the extent and the nature of the damage. So that report was issued last year.
So the estimated total cost of just the repairs and maintenance that you'll be doing is in excess of $1 million?
Mr. Chairman, if we were to do all of the things that were required or pointed out as deficiencies, it would be $1.1 million. We're proposing to replace it with an entirely new structure that is compliant to serve the space and operate more efficiently for about $2 million. We would propose to demolish this structure.
I see. And build on site to where the Whitaker Hall is presently standing?
Or near.
I see. What portion of the $1+ million would be used at this particular point then for the issues? As I see it, right now it's the request is $134,700 for the design. Now that's for the replacement itself. Okay. And the repairs are being taken care of out of your regular repair budget?
Correct.
That's correct.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'd misunderstood that there was some rather significant amount of work that appears in the pictures. There was some rather, with the scaffolding and so forth, some significant work going into this building right now.
No, Mr. Chairman, what that was, the wall, the stucco wall on the outside was beginning to peel away, and when they took that off, they discovered that there were some structural members that had been pretty much eaten through. Those have been replaced, and the total project to patch it back together is about $30,000, which was paid from our regular maintenance budget.
So that's all maintenance. We're looking at a capital outlay of $134,700 here.
Yes, sir, for future construction.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. We appreciate that. And the last department which we have not heard from is Employment Department with a request from the Eugene Field Office. Here from the Department of Employment. Okay. Welcome, Ms. Crosby.
Chair members, I'm Brenda Crosby, Director for Employment Department.
This piece in your consideration today is actually involving the purchase of our current Eugene Field Office building. We currently lease that. And in order to achieve long-term lease savings, we often consider whether it's appropriate to purchase a building. This is built into our budget request and has been reviewed. We would be paying for this building should you approve it. The two types of funding, both other funds. One is the certificate of participation, which was referred to earlier, and the other is REIT Act funds, which is available from the federal government for purposes like this. And we currently own 10 of our buildings of our 47 sites, and the operating cost for those owned buildings is about 45 cents per square foot compared to an average leased facility cost of about $1.06 per square foot. Over the long term, this has allowed us to put more direct dollars into service delivery rather than actually lease and rentals. In this particular facility, we do have letters of, if you will, recommendation from both the city planning people in Eugene and also this particular type of unemployment insurance and employment service delivery is moving toward one-stop. We do have the one-stop partners on board, and they would, in fact, be participants in that particular site should this be made available to us. We do have statutory authority to accept REIT Act for this type of purpose. However, we have brought to the attention of Legislative Fiscal that there would be an amendment, and we have talked to them about language, which I believe they will be talking to you about, because the bill is required to actually put the amount of REIT Act that we would be accepting for this particular project.
Could you give us the calculations again of the lease versus the purchase and the issues there in place this problem?
Under the certificate of participation, we would be borrowing $1,380,000, and in REIT Act funds, we would actually be receiving interest-free but pay back over a 10-year period of about $1,120,000. The actual lease and the rentals that we would get, and the Internal Revenue Service is a current participant of that building, and we do not expect any negative cash flow over the biennium. In other words, it would equate to the amount that we're paying out in lease to actually pay for those two purposes.
Basically, what you'll do is by using the REIT Act funds, repaying those over 10 years without interest, and then leasing out a portion of that facility to the Internal Revenue Service, thus obtaining your one-stop concept for employers to pick up federal ID and information and those kinds of things.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. There would be interest on the certificate of participation, but that's also in the calculation of that no negative cash flow.
Give me, if you will, please, the rental, the monthly, or the per square foot rental versus ownership.
Ask my budget manager to provide. The ones I've already told you about? Okay, I just thought you meant over the life of the... It's 45 cents per square foot. That's the average operating cost for our owned facilities versus a leased facility average of $1.06 per square foot. And I do have the bullets that I'm covering today in a sheet that if you like, and I can also make those letters of recommendation from both the Eugene as well as our partnerships available to you.
I think those were presented to the original committee.
Some of them were, not all of them were, yes.
Mm-hmm. So it costs you to rent $1.06 per square foot, and the ownership is 45 cents under this arrangement, and that 45 cents includes the certificate of participation interest.
This is, I think, after we pay for them, Mr. Chair.
After the...
Correct.
So the 45 cents plus debt service then.
Correct.
Representative Mussel is recognized.
Mr. Chair, what all is included in that 45 cents? How did they raise it?
Chair, Representative Mussel, if I could ask my business manager to join me.
For the record, my name is Gary Barker, business manager of the Employment Department. 45 $0.05 represents the ongoing cost that we have in maintaining the physical structure. So roof repair, heating, ventilation, air conditioning, any plumbing, kind of the maintenance activity that would keep the building up.
That's the current price for just regular repairs and maintenance.
Right, and it does vary. That's an average that we developed from our 10-owned offices in comparison to what we would expect to pay in Eugene. It does vary. We don't have a roof problem every year, but it averages out to about that amount.
Current rental in Eugene, how much is it per square foot?
We are paying in our Eugene office right now $1.45 per square foot, which is slightly below the agency average.
There are obviously other costs such as opportunity costs and purchase costs and those kind of things that you do not include in your ownership.
Chair Butler and Ripson, there are some other costs that I didn't mention, the ongoing costs of janitorial service, the ongoing costs of electricity, and probably one or two others that I can't think of.
So the $1.06 includes the custodial and the...
That's a full service.
Utility, that's full service.
Correct.
And the $0.45 is just R&M, or repairs and maintenance.
That's correct. It's outside, as Rowena said, outside of the...
Have you done an apples-to-apples comparison, Mr. Barker?
It sounds like, Mr. Chair, that a budget person is saying that it does include some of the costs that you're talking about. It just does not include the debt service at $0.45. We also have leases that sometimes mean that we're still responsible for different types of repairs or different types of like janitorial services. So some, these are averages that we're talking about.
Mr. John Benton is with us from the Legislative Fiscal. Would you like to?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Natchley. I asked for a cash flow analysis from the Employment Department, and they gave it to me, and I looked at the net present value and internal rate of return, and a recommendation is that they go ahead with the deal. Didn't look at the square footage cost, but I did, and the cash flow analysis includes all costs, including heating and maintenance, as well as the repayment of the COPs and the
redeck.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. I think we've heard each of the various items.
Mr. Chair, the only thing I would call to your attention is I think you've been distributed the proposed budget note that they talked about yesterday in relation to Parks and Recreation. You may want to take a look at that. And I understand from your earlier comments that we're going to come back on Saturday and do additional work on this budget. We might think, well, you can't see any action on it.
We probably should acknowledge receipt of the the proposed budget notes. Do you want to read that into the record?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nestle, the budget note is proposed in relation to the conversation that was and testimony that was provided yesterday relating to the Parks and Recreation Commission and Port of Brookings Harbor is this. Quote, the Oregon Parks and Recreation Commission is directed to work with the Port of Brookings Harbor to identify financing alternatives for maintenance and management of Fort Haven Beach, including but not limited to the maintenance of general public access, restroom facilities, and safety at the public beach. The director shall provide a report on the results of these efforts to the emergency board by April 1, 2000.
Thank you very much. We will also acknowledge receipt into the file from
Larry Nussbaum, Legislative Fiscal Office, Legislative Fiscal Office analysis of the Public Safety Subcommittee recommendations relative to the Department of Corrections, I believe, yes, Department of Corrections Capital Construction Project, which he has gone through with the Public Safety Commission. So that's made part of our record here.
Chair?
Representative Nussbaum.
I'd also like to add into the record that in regards to the studies by Parks Department and the Port of Brookings Harbor, I've had communication with both the Parks Department and the Port of Brookings representatives, and that budget note is finally come.
Okay. And I have extra copies of the budget notice. Anyone would like a copy?
Thank you very much. We'll make sure we append that for the final budget. Okay. If there are no further issues, Representative Metro, it looks like we outlasted them all again, pretty much. We'll go ahead and close this portion of we actually started off as a work session, but it really. Really couldn't have been a work session much after about first few couple minutes, and then we'll reschedule Senate Bill 5527 at the later date. So, thank you very much. Thank you.